She ate a bowl of cold soup in her room while flipping through the coloring book. Most of it had crumbled away, but there were still two pages attached by a single staple. Both were loose sheets of paper, not part of the coloring book proper. No pictures, no lines to stay inside. Just the raw imagination of a child. Lara worried for that child. The first page depicted a long ribbon of blue with a fish poking its head out. A river. In front of it was an oblong shape done up in beige. All along its length, little pockets of red and yellow and orange stood out. There wasn't much detail, but Lara took them to be fires. Down in the corner stood a dark shape. It was indistinct, without clear outlines. But the child had taken great pains to fill in the space. Lara ran a finger across the area. Even after all this time, there were gouges in the paper. Someone had taken a crayon and run it over the area again and again, pressing down as hard as they could. In the center, a single red dot. The second picture was much worse. In it, a boy with a frowny face lay on the ground. Unnaturally large tears leapt out from both eyes and arced toward the ground. Next to him was what could only be described as a monster, a hideous three-legged, four-armed beast with the head of a dog. Every hand held a cigarette. Two of the cigarettes were being pressed into the boy's belly. Above the two of them hung a single bare bulb. Again, darkness was emphasized, the tracks from the black crayon like veins in the paper. Lara took a breath and flipped back to the first picture, the foot encased in a sandal. There was no proof, of course, that any of this had to do with Hobbs's victims, but something inside her recoiled at the sight of these crude drawings. They had the same flavor of sickness she associated with Hobbs. Could he have passed that sickness on to a child? Why not? As his diary made clear, it had been passed on to him like some kind of psychological virus. Sometimes a virus kills its host. Sometimes it leaves them alive but infected. A carrier. Obsession is never healthy, Jasmine said. And what about the alternative? If I never even try to look for her, by default I spend the rest of my life not knowing. Jasmine nodded. That's called acceptance, Laura. And believe it or not, that is a healthy response to certain adversities. We cannot change certain things, and we are not responsible for changing them. All we can do is endure. Like you said, we have to live with it. She crossed her arms. It seems like a coward's excuse. Jasmine took a minute to sip from her water glass. Lara had known her long enough to recognize the look on her face. She was collecting her thoughts. In the past, she said finally, I've had patients diagnosed with a terminal illness. The situation is in some way similar. They're confronted with not only their own mortality, but also with a profound lack of agency. Often the disease isn't the result of any choice they made or didn't make. It exists as something completely outside their control. If a person like that tried to work toward accepting their fate, would you call it cowardice? Of course not. There's a lot to be said for going out with dignity. So they should know when to quit. You can stop right there. It's a false analogy. Terminal cancer is one thing. Finding Samantha Powell is something else entirely. How do you see them as different? Finding Samantha isn't a lost cause. The doctor drank some more water. Samantha is a very sweet girl with a very troubled home life. I offered my help to Sheriff Fuller, but he didn't seem interested. I'm interested. You're not the police. But I'm here, and I'm involved whether I like it or not. He sent me an ear, Jasmine. Here, take a look at these. Lara spread the pictures of the crosses out on the low coffee table and explained where she'd gotten them. What do you think? Some kind of trophy? It's a leap, Jasmine said. A gold cross necklace must be the most common piece of jewelry besides earrings. Even I wear one. She patted a lump underneath her shirt. So you think it's just coincidence? No, I think it's more than that. I think it's a product of your need to know. Lara groaned. And just like that, back to doctor and patient. Listen, do you know mountain laurel? The plant? She nodded. When I was a girl, we used to spend summers in the mountains. I was an only child, and when my parents were busy, I would climb up into high places to be alone. I loved those flowers, the pinks and the whites. To me, they were crowns and necklaces and hair clips. Anywhere there was mountain laurel, there was sure to be a wind that would keep me cool after climbing. I thought it was like magic, that the plants themselves summoned the wind. I liked to pretend they summoned it just for me. But of course I had it backwards. The air carries the moisture a plant requires. There's a moral in there somewhere, I'm sure. I know I'm being obtuse. Here's my point. You have a gut feeling that these gold crosses are a clue, right? Right. Not right. You need to come to terms with the fact that you can't trust your gut feelings. You're in a very vulnerable place, with a deep need for closure. How could your feelings possibly be objective? You need to find that these necklaces have meaning, so you decide that they do, not the other way around. You think it's nothing, Laura said. Jasmine put a hand on her knee, a look of concern on her face. In the laurels, there was always a fresh breeze, because fresh breezes are where laurels grow. Chapter 30. Cooper had bounded off around the old tree stump, sniffing delicately at the dirt. Once the dog was sufficiently occupied, she told him about the ear. At first he thought it was good news, a sign that Teresa Mitchum was still alive. So she told him it was another left ear, and watched his wishful thinking crease and buckle under the weight of another missing girl.
Jesus, Roger said,
and bent over with his hands on his knees, taking quick breaths, his face the color of used-up charcoal. Seems Fuller's main concern is avoiding bad press. He's hunkered down for the winter. Rogers straightened himself up.
What about your boyfriend? What did he say?
Who, Tominski? She tried on a smile, but it dropped away when he didn't respond in kind. He's off it. OCSO isn't calling in the cavalry, so he's probably not even in the state anymore. But he let me take another look in the cabin.
You really think anyone would be stupid enough to go back there?
No, but I'm working backwards here. If there really is a third man, then this whole thing was designed to bring Hobbs out into the light. Rogers rubbed his shoulder.
Easier ways to do that.
Fuller said the same, but go with me here. Say that's the case. Who would know about Hobbs? Who would want all of us to know about him? Rogers rubbed his chin.
Someone who knew him personally, I suppose.
Exactly. I mean, a guy like Hobbs. He cuts a swath of destruction through people's lives.
And generally ends those lives.
But what if he didn't? She shoved her hands deeper into her pockets. Somewhere, sometime, a person tangled with Hobbs, but escaped with less than a death sentence. That's the kind of person who might want some measure of revenge. Rogers squinted at her.
You think your third man is someone Hobbs abused as a child?
Laura nodded. And now they're all grown up.
That's a hell of a broad profile. We don't have the slightest inkling what Hobbs was up to for the last 29 years.
That's why we need to focus on what we do know. We need to concentrate on the murders from the late 80s. She produced the manila envelope from inside her jacket and handed it to Rogers. He pulled out the photos, examined them, then shrugged.
What am I looking at here?
Tominski and I found them in the cabin.
Gold crosses.
I was thinking trophies. He let out a sharp breath.
That's a stretch. Besides, there are four of them.
Laura said nothing. In a second, he worked it out for himself.
A fourth girl all those years ago?
It's not impossible, is it? Let's go inside, she said. They warmed their hands over the wood-burning stove in the kitchen, and Rogers put the kettle on. When it whistled, he poured out two measures of hot water into teacups, then pulled out his bottle of bourbon. She shook her head once. Not today.
Warms the soul, he said,
but acquiesced, screwing on the cap and putting the bottle into a cabinet. He handed Laura her tea. She sipped at it. Just say I'm right. Who could the fourth victim be?
Lot of girls, potentially. Back when it was happening, we would assume the worst every time a girl went missing. Most of them were home safe and sound within a day. That's how missing persons always works. But some weren't.
They could have been taken by Hobbs.
Sure, or 100 other things. We never found them posed in a field. Sometimes people just disappear, and that includes children. It doesn't take a serial killer. Lara chewed on that, then said, Let's just keep assuming the theory is true, though. One of those girls was actually taken by Hobbs.
But he didn't pose her in a field, Rogers said.
He didn't even kill her. That's the whole idea. Do you have files on the possibles?
Of course. I've got copies of everything.
They spent the rest of the day and most of the night reading. At midnight, Don Rogers stretched and yawned and pushed his chair back from the kitchen table.
I'm done for the night, he said.
You sure?
When you get older, you'll understand. Past a certain age and hour, the mind turns to Swiss cheese. I'll be more use after a good night's rest.
Lara started packing up some of the file folders strewn across the tabletop. I can take a hint.
No, stay if you want.
I'll take off. We can pick up tomorrow. He crossed his arms.
How many cups of coffee have you had?
3.
In the last hour, maybe.
Okay, call it 3+.
You drink coffee like a cop. I remember those days, sucking down a metric ton of caffeine and then lying in bed, staring at the ceiling and listening to my heart jitter. Really, you can stay.
If you're sure.
I'm sure, he said.
Couch is in the den when you crash. Besides, Cooper can use the company. He hooked his thumb over his shoulder. On a thick rug in front of the wood-burning stove, Cooper slept on his side, belly toward the heat. Every few seconds, he let out a snore.
Okay, see you in the morning, Lara said. Once Rogers had closed the door to his room, she unstacked the file folders, trying to return them to their previous positions. One stack was for unread, and then there were several stacks for already examined. One stack for no, one for the maybes, one for the files she had unresolved questions about. She plucked up another and got back to reading. An hour and a half later, she found it. The folder was labeled with a name, Finch, Patty. Inside was a copy of the police report, a photo of the girl, and something else. Rogers had taken from the official file 2 sheets of construction paper. Both had drawings on them. One of a house, in front of it a boy and a man, hand in hand, smiling. The second one she recognized. It was the same blue ribbon, the same beige oval. The picture in the Patty Finch file. The picture from the cabin. They'd been done by the same person. She could feel it in her bones. 3 quick raps brought Rogers out of his room, bleary-eyed.
What the hell, Lara?
I found it. Here, look. She laid the file open on the table in front of him.
So what?
He said and rubbed at the stubble on his chin, yawning. As an ex-cop, you're not going to like this next part. He frowned.
Go on.
When I was at the cabin with Tominski, I took something. He didn't say anything, just glowered at her. Wait here a second. She threw on her coat and bundled out to her car, came back inside with the coloring book clutched to her chest. In the kitchen, Rogers was fully awake, more than awake, his nostrils flared in anger.
Christ, Lara, you can't take things from a crime scene. Say it has any value at all. What use will it be in court?
She pressed the coloring book flat on the table and turned to the page, then lined it up next to the one from the file folder. Rogers froze, staring at them. They're the same, right? Lara said, unable to hide the excitement in her voice. When Rogers spoke, no excitement colored his inflection. Words came out in a flat monotone.
You found this in the cabin. Hobbs's cabin.
Yes? What's wrong? His lower lip trembled as he tapped the name on the file folder.
Patty Finch. I know this girl.
Of course, you've read all these files 100 times. He shook his head.
No, you don't understand. I met her. I found her. More than once.
Chapter 31.
The Finches, Roger said, were new in town. Just the mother and the daughter, Mildred and Patty. The girl was a sweetheart. You saw the picture?
Lara nodded.
Doesn't capture her at all. That was the only photo we could get, and she looks happy in it. She didn't look happy in real life.
In real life, she looked like a puppy that'd been kicked too many times. Nice as can be, but she'd cringe every time you lifted your hand.
Lara paused. What happened to her?
He stared at her for a second.
You live with your mother, don't you? Can't help but notice you never talk about her.
No, not much, she said, and left it at that.
Can I assume it's not exactly a loving relationship?
You could assume that, yes.
Same for me. Only I can tell that whatever your mama did to you, it wasn't physical. Otherwise, you'd understand exactly what I'm describing. A kid who's been hit so many times, from so many angles, that the possibility of violence starts to live in the back of their mind, like a ghost. Never really there, never really gone. Hell, I still can't be around a person carrying a cane without the hair on the back of my neck standing up.
Your father?
He gave a curt nod. The Finch girl was like me. I knew it the second I saw her. Tried to talk to Mildred, the mom, but she was hard to track down. Never home. Always some excuse.
Any hint of what might have happened to Patty?
This was before she disappeared. It wasn't the first time I'd run into that. A kid with a less than stellar home life. And usually the parents were just about what you'd expect. Drunks, antisocial personalities. But Mildred Finch was different.
Not a drunk, Lara said.
No way. Very sharp. She had the good mother act down pat.
But it was an act. He thought about that.
Hell, I don't know. I think so. The little girl was being beaten, I'm sure of that much.
And her mother?
His eyes narrowed to coin slots.
No kid is that good of an actor, and one of them was putting me on. Who does that leave?
Lara saw something in his face that made the backs of her hands tingle. Here in his kitchen, she suddenly had the sense of what it must have been like to sit across from him at the interrogation table. And the thought of it made her a little bit scared.
I'm sorry, he said, sensing her hesitation. Bad memories. She ran away 3 times. The first time, she tried to recruit another girl in her class to run away with her. Well, the other girl got scared and told her mama, and her mama called the police. They dispatched me, and I found her waiting in the spot they'd arranged, all ready to go. You rarely see that in a 10-year-old. A total readiness to brave the big bad world. No hesitation.
She made a real impression on you, Lara said. Rogers turned his head to hide his face.
She was a good kid. Second time she tried to go on her own, someone spotted her with a bindle, a piece of cloth tied to a stick. She probably saw it on TV somewhere. I found her down near the bridge south of downtown.
And the third time?
He groaned.
I should have known. It never felt right.
Lara put a hand on top of his. I'm sure you did what you could. He drew back from her, used his other hand to rub the spot she'd touched like it had been burned by acid.
Don't do that. Don't pretend you can judge whether my search was adequate. You don't know how hard I looked.
Okay, Lara said. How hard did you look? He paused, staring at the wall. When he spoke, it was softer than before.
The third time, she went to the old Speedway.
Lara knew what he meant. On the outskirts of Hillsboro stood a remnant from the early days of stock car racing. It dated from before the sport was televised, before it even had professional drivers. They raced on a dirt track, and years of tires and footsteps had packed the topsoil down good and tight. The track was still there.
Out by the river, Lara said.
Out by the river,
Rogers agreed, and tapped a finger on the beige oval from the coloring book. Lara's hand went to her mouth.
The track.
Looks like it to me,
he said, and went to the cabinet to retrieve his bottle of bourbon.
The third time, Patty Finch went to the track and tried to find someone to give her a ride away from Hillsboro. Once her mother reported her missing, people started coming forward saying they'd seen her.
Did she get a ride?
No one knew. Of course, the track hadn't been used by NASCAR in decades, but it hosted an exhibition race.
I forget why, and there were people from all over. Always thought one of them gave her a lift, gave her the head start she always wanted. I figured that's why I couldn't find her.
He poured a slug of bourbon into his empty coffee cup and downed it in one swallow.
She gave him a minute, then asked,
"You never considered her as a possible victim of the kid?"
He shook his head. "Not seriously. She wanted to run away so bad. Tried so many times. We all just assumed she finally succeeded. Maybe that's just what I wanted to believe."
He poured and drank again.
"You said they were new in town."
"They came that winter. Patty registered at the school halfway through the year. I remember that much. By the time summer rolled around, she was gone."
"Where did they come from?"
"It's all in the file."
She paged through his notes, found a notation that read "previous address," scrawled across the page.
"Here,"
she said.
"It's coming back. Never could get a straight answer out of Mildred Finch. Fact is, I only got to question her twice, maybe three times. She moved again."
Laura sat back. Her daughter disappeared, and she moved away that quickly?
Rogers nodded.
"Seems like a lot of parents might be inclined to stick around, assist in the search. And if they really thought their daughter ran away, they might want to be there in case the child tried to come home."
"You heard my opinion of her," he said. "When I found out she was gone, it wasn't a surprise."
"No forwarding address?" Rogers didn't answer, just filled his cup again.
"We need to track her down."
He sighed.
"This is a real lead, Laura. You keep tugging at the thread. What are you going to find? I'm worried about you."
"I'm not letting this one get away."
"Let's try talking to Fuller together. I used to be sheriff. He'll listen."
"You can try if you want, but he wants nothing to do with me."
She took a breath.
"I'm a pariah."
"It's dangerous now. You shouldn't do this alone."
"So help me. Don't quit 10 yards from the finish line. You of all people should be ready to back me up."
"The police can do that."
"Christ, take a teaspoon of concrete and harden the fuck up."
He shrugged.
"I'm an old man, Laura. I've been looking for Eugene Hobbs for almost 30 years. And now I found him. Haven't I done enough?"
Laura shook her head violently. "Hobbs may be gone, but the other one is still out there. We need to find him. Olive Hansen is dead, but Teresa Mitchum might still be alive. Samantha Powell might still be alive."
"You don't want to end up like me. It's always something, always one more clue, one more hint. I guess I just can't do it anymore."
She grabbed her coat and slipped her arms inside.
"All these years you've been thinking about this case, turning it over in your mind. You know what would cure that? The truth. An answer about what really happened. Maybe saving a little girl's life."
She gestured to the kitchen filled with file boxes, in the corner of his shabby house, perched among the failing lonely field.
"You're right. I don't want to end up like this."
He stared at her for a second. Then his shoulders sagged, and he reached for the bottle on the table, poured some into a random glass. When he spoke, his voice was near breaking.
"I just don't have another one in me."
She went to leave.
"Wait, come back and see me again."
"I'm going to be running this thing down, maybe in a couple days."
She opened the door.
2 days, he said. "Call at least, so I know you're okay. Promise me."
"I promise," she said.
She turned back, and he did look different. Smaller somehow. As if all along he'd been a set of those Russian nesting dolls, and now someone had stripped away the defiant exterior shell, revealing the smaller broken one inside. Chapter 32.
"I think I've got something here, Tim."
"What time is it?"
"After 2. Did I wake you?"
"Hold on."
A sound like the rustling of sheets.
"Are you alone?"
The shuffling of footsteps, the click of a door latch shooting home.
"Sorry, you caught me off guard."
"I shouldn't have called."
"No, it's good to hear your voice."
Quickly, she ran down the story, stealing the coloring book,
matching it to an old sheriff's office file, and finding the name associated with that file, a possible fourth victim. At the end, Tominski said,
"You stole evidence?"
"I knew that'd bother you."
"We have to pretend you never told me about this.
Or you'll cuff me?"
"I'm not playing."
Steel in his voice.
"You just admitted a felony to a federal agent. And don't tell Fuller about this. He'll arrest you just to shut you up. Even if there was another one, where does that leave us?"
"You should take credit for the connection. Maybe get yourself a nice office out of it."
"You mean the connection made using stolen evidence? I can't have anything to do with that."
"Not even if we can catch this guy?"
"I'm not going to report you or anything. I just can't help."
"I understand."
"That's probably not what you want to hear, but I've got other things to..."
"Tell it to Angie Mitchum," she said and hung up the phone. She thought of Angie Mitchum, sitting in a worn smooth pew and clutching her Bible, then glanced down at the images from the coloring book. She'd lined them up on her bed before calling, like soldiers marching across her duvet. 2 feet in old-fashioned sandals, one big, one small. Sudden recognition flashed through her mind. There was a story that fit the bill. David and Goliath. After a series of gradually narrowing internet searches, she had a spreadsheet with the name and contact information for every publisher that might deal in religious coloring books. To each, she sent a brief email explaining the situation and attached an image of the page with the foot in the sandal. It asked that they forward the message along to anyone who purchased such coloring books in bulk. Then she copied the message and sent it along to an ever-widening circle of government agencies, group homes, and churches. She played on their better angels, emphasizing the chance to save a child and imploring them to call if any of their staff recognized the page. It was a long shot, but better ideas were in short supply. At the bottom of each message, she added her phone number. Stranger and stranger, Patty Finch didn't have a birth certificate. Laura spent the morning and early afternoon on the phone with the state of North Carolina, then with all the surrounding states. Her skills came in handy as she managed to sweet-talk each government office into doing a quick search for her. Each state was adamant that no Patricia Finch had been born in the last 100 years. Other variations of the name were also a bust. The only thing left to go on was the missing persons report. It listed an address, and at 4 in the afternoon, Laura parked and knocked on the front door. After a few minutes, she knocked again, just before the door opened. "So sorry to keep you waiting," the woman said. She sported an elegant housecoat, almost like a kimono, and a shock of white hair as thick as the strand of pearls around her neck. In one hand, she clutched an ivory-handled cane. Laura guessed she was at least 80 years old. "Not quite as spry as I used to be." "Please, no apologies necessary. I was hoping someone could tell me about some tenants who used to live here." "There are no tenants here, I'm afraid." This would have been quite a while ago, back in 1987 and 1988. The Finches. The old woman nodded once. "Yes, of course. The little girl who disappeared." Laura was staggered by her luck. "You remember them?" "Absolutely. I've lived in this house more than 40 years. I was their landlord, I suppose." "May I come in?" The woman stood aside and swung her cane out of the way. The old woman, whose name turned out to be Vivian Kaufman, got Laura settled in a chair in the parlor and then tottered off to the kitchen. 5 minutes later, she returned with tea on a sterling silver tray. She balanced one side of the tray on the top of her cane and scooted along quite efficiently. Before Laura could offer to help, everything was down on the coffee table, and Vivian was pouring her a cup of Earl Grey. "Milk or sugar?"
"No, thank you."
"You're not from North Carolina," Laura observed.
"No, my husband was. He was a military man, moved around a lot. We met in Chicago, and after we married, he wanted to move back here. He passed a few years ago."
"I'm sorry." Vivian waved a hand.
"No need to be. Now, what's your interest in the Finch girl?"
Laura decided to keep it simple. "I'm working on a story for the Gazette about missing children."
"She's still missing, then?"
"As far as I know." Vivian sighed.
I'd always hoped she made it somewhere.
Somewhere?
Oh, I don't know. Somewhere nice, I suppose. Alan was a wonderful husband and a good father, but he was the one who insisted we move to Hillsboro. I've been here for a long time, and I'm too old to move now. But it was never my first choice.
Are you a native? Does that offend you?
I moved away for a long time myself.
But you came back. Why?
Laura paused. I guess I had nowhere else to go.
She nodded.
As good a reason as any. It was clear to me that little Patty Finch wanted nothing to do with this town. They were only here a matter of months before she started running away.
Why did they move here?
Vivian sipped her tea, then said, Mildred Finch told me they were in hiding.
Laura sat up straight. In hiding? What does that mean?
She told me they were on the run from her husband. You have to understand, this was 1987. It was a different time. If a woman's husband liked to hit her, sometimes there wasn't much she could do but learn to take a punch.
And Mildred Finch's husband hit her?
She told me horrible stories about him. Just horrible. What I know for sure is that she spun a very compelling yarn.
They looked at each other for a moment.
I have to say, Vivian, it doesn't sound like you were totally convinced.
An old house like this has thick walls. People assume privacy, she said. But in the late 1970s, we updated the heating vents. After that, for a number of years until we got it fixed, every word spoken in every room could be heard sitting right where you are now.
Laura leaned forward in her chair.
Where I used to sit at night, Vivian said.
And what did you hear?
A very nasty woman saying very nasty things. A mother who seemed to enjoy cruelty for cruelty's sake.
And you never told anyone?
I considered it. But as I said, it was a different time. Hitting your child wasn't even really frowned upon, much less illegal. I was seriously considering shaming her in public, but Patty up and disappeared. Soon they were both gone.
Laura said, and you never spoke of it after that? The police must have asked you questions.
She paused, withdrew a handkerchief from inside the folds of her housecoat, and daubed at her eyes.
I came home one day and there was a police car parked right out there at the curb. If I'm being honest, my first thought was that Mildred had killed her. But no, she had escaped instead. I was happy for her, you see. I hoped she would get away and somehow make a fresh start.
So when the police asked you questions, I didn't tell them a damn thing, Vivian said.
Laura tried to think where to go next. She asked,
Mildred moved out after that?
Couldn't get out fast enough. Her daughter disappears, and she's in the wind within a week. That should tell you all you need to know.
Do you know where she went?
I do not. I never spoke to her again.
How about where they came from? Where did they live with Mr. Finch?
Vivian set her teacup down and steepled her fingers. Let me see. It was from somewhere farther north. I remember that much.
In Virginia.
Chesapeake? No, that's not right. Somewhere on the border.
I don't know Virginia very well, Laura said.
That's a shame. The old memory isn't what it used to be. You seem sharp as a tack.
Now isn't that sweet of you to say?
Laura stood. Thank you for your time, Vivian. It was a pleasure to meet you.
And you as well, Laura. Tell me, there must be runaways more recent than 1988. How does Patty Finch fit into your story?
I can't give you all the details, ma'am.
Vivian smiled knowingly.
I think you're trying to find her.
Laura said nothing.
Best of luck, she said and showed her to the door.
Laura got three steps down the walk before the old woman stopped her.
Mecklenburg, she said. They came from Mecklenburg, Virginia. I'm sure of it.
As it turned out, there was no city in Virginia called Mecklenburg. But it was the name of a county. Another hour on the phone, and she had something solid. Mecklenburg County had a 1979 marriage license for a John Lauder and a Mildred Finch. It listed an address. With that in hand, she called the office dealing with the area's property records and flirted with a lonely-sounding man until he agreed to find the information about that particular piece of land and read it to her over the phone.
The property was a farm at the southern edge of the county, almost into North Carolina, and sprawled more than 500 acres. The current owner was listed as Monica Finch. She drove north on I-85 for 40 miles, then broke off onto US 15 for another 35. A two-lane bridge carried across the half-mile span of the Roanoke River, and she crossed it as the last drops of sun evaporated off the river's surface, and watched as the water turned to ink. 10 more minutes and she made Boyton, the county seat. She checked into a motel, took a shower, and forced herself to sleep. By dawn on Saturday, she was winding down country roads, looking for the farm's entrance. The weather was better here, a touch warmer with blue skies. Despite the excellent visibility, she almost missed the turn. A battered red mailbox listed to one side, nearly hidden in 3-foot grass. It had Finch hand-painted on the side in uneven white letters. Laura hit the brakes, and the dart slid on the gravel, but she made the turn. The driveway was in worse condition than the road, rutted by erosion, and it took 10 minutes to reach the end. The trees ended, and the property gave way to cleared fields with a house on a rise in the center. It looked like something out of Gone with the Wind, with a huge front porch under a sagging roof supported by white columns. She parked and knocked. No answer. She knocked again and waited. Hello? Laura jumped. The voice came from behind her. She turned to face its owner and found a woman only a few years older than her. Monica Finch? That's right. She had vibrant red hair and freckles dotted her cheeks. Crow's feet had just started at the edges of her eyes, but they gave her a friendly look, as if she smiled a lot. From behind her leg, another voice said, Mommy? A little girl stepped out but kept clutching her mother's pant leg. She was Monica in miniature, freckles more prominent, red hair bound up in pigtails. Can I help you? Monica asked. I'm a reporter working on a story.
Like for the paper?
The little girl interrupted. The two of them were up on the porch now, and Laura bent down on one knee. And who's this? Her mother smiled.
This is Francine.
Laura extended a hand and Francine shook it, a serious look on her face.
Pleased to meet you, she said.
Laura grinned. Likewise. Yes, I write the stories that go in the paper.
How do you know all those things?
Well, I don't, but lots of different people know lots of different things, and my job is to ask them questions about it. Francine nodded, and her nose scrunched up as she processed this revelation about the nature of journalism.
What a polite little girl, she said to Monica. We try our best. Is this about the runoff into Smithfield Creek? We don't actually farm the land anymore, so I'm not sure I have anything to say.
The runoff, Laura repeated. Monica said,
but I am against pollution.
Who isn't?
Exactly.
But I'm not here about the runoff into Smithfield Creek. Monica frowned. I'm up here from Hillsborough, North Carolina. Monica stared at her for another second, recognition dawning on her face. She recoiled away across the porch, in what Laura suspected was an unconscious gesture. One arm grabbed Francine's shoulder and pushed the little girl behind her leg again.
Mommy?
Shh.
Quiet now, sweetheart.
To Laura.
I recognize you. You're the woman who led the police to that serial killer.
Chapter 33. But why do you want to talk to me? Laura watched the wheels turn in Monica's head. Reporter, infamous for her connection to serial killer, wants an interview, which cannot possibly mean anything good. The woman took a sudden interest in her surroundings, looking behind her, then scanning the horizon. Why do you want to talk to me? She repeated, a new urgency in her tone. Laura raised both hands, palms out. It's nothing like that, nothing dangerous. I'm just doing backstory. Can I come inside? The sun broke free of the tree line and bathed the porch in golden light. Monica squinted at her.
If it's all the same to you, we can talk right here.
Laura stood and waited. Any person who had raised a child with such excellent manners must have a strong sense of decorum themselves. She thought it would play to her advantage, so she said nothing. It only took another second for Monica to break. We can talk out here, but I'll get us some coffee from the kitchen. Cream, sugar,
Black. Back in a sec. Have a seat, she said, and pulled Francine along behind her as she vanished through the front door. Francine waved and then disappeared inside before Laura could wave back. There was an Adirondack chair that proved comfortable, and Laura dug out her pad and pencil and balanced them on its flat arm. Monica backed through the screen door with a cup of coffee in each hand and gave one to Laura. Behind her, the screen door poked open a few inches. You stay inside, she said, and the visible sliver of Francine's face receded from view. Monica was well-mannered enough to let Laura get in a few sips of coffee before speaking. This is all very strange. I should have called ahead. Monica ignored that. What could you possibly want to talk about? How do I fit into a story about a child killer? I really need you to tell me that right now. She nodded back toward the door. Should I be worried? Laura shook her head. I didn't know you had a daughter. If I had, I definitely would have called. Like I said, this is just backstory. What kind of backstory? Laura had spent most of the drive thinking about this moment. For the last 6 months, she had never hesitated to lie in service of the bigger truth. Here, though, things were different. Monica deserved to know. To this woman, sitting in front of her, Patty Finch was blood. Before I say anything at all, Laura said, I need you to understand a few things. My job is just like I explained it to Francine, visiting people and asking questions. Hopefully, I end up with something close to the truth. Right now, I'm in the middle of that process. I don't know anything for sure. Monica set her coffee cup down on the low table between them. Now you're scaring me. Just give me a headline, something I can wrap my head around. Laura nodded. Okay, fair enough. Another girl disappeared in Hillsboro. And I think there may be a connection to Mildred Finch and her daughter Patty. She watched carefully for Monica's reaction. Would it be fear? Or despair? Anxiety? She studied her face, attuned to any sign that this woman had knowledge that would help. Monica cocked her head to one side, eyebrows raised. Aunt Mildred? She was your aunt then? Laura hadn't been sure about the exact familial relationship, only that an owner of this exact property named Finch could not possibly be a coincidence. Yes, Monica said, my mother's sister. Do you know where she is? She shook her head. I haven't seen her since I was a little girl, younger than Francine. And your mother? Would she know how to find her? No, they were never close. When she left for good. Laura took a breath. This was the moment, the question she'd been waiting to ask, and it surprised her how difficult it was to get the words out. It was fear, she realized. She was afraid of this woman's answer. She was scared of being right. What about her daughter, Patty? Monica made a face. Has anyone in the family had contact with her since 1988? Why 1988? Laura pressed her. Has anyone had contact with her? No, my Aunt Mildred took Patty with her when she left, 2 years before that. I don't think it was considered strange at the time. Nobody knew we'd never see them again. Do you think it's possible another family member might have talked to them, tracked them down, even gotten a postcard from them during the last 29 years? Monica held up a hand. I need you to stop right there. I've answered your questions, but I think I need you to answer a few of mine before we go any further. Laura drained the last of her coffee and set the cup down. This will sound a little crazy. Monica crossed her arms over her chest. You know the man who killed those girls? Eugene Hobbs. Yes. He also killed 3 girls in 1988. The first evidence we have of him committing a crime. I think there's a possibility he killed a 4th girl back then. Monica just stared at her, unmoving, unblinking. And I think it's possible that 4th girl was your cousin, Patty. She summarized the rest, the coloring books, the crosses, the tenuous connections holding everything together. At the end, Monica said, I'm not sure that really proves anything. Of course, Laura agreed. Like I said, I'm in the process of investigating. I may very well be wrong. Partly I hoped you would tell me so, that Patty is alive and well and living in New York or something. She shook her head. No, we don't know what happened to them, but...
Mommy?
The door poked open again.
Yes, sweetheart?
I'm thirsty.
Get yourself a glass of water then, like a big girl.
When her daughter was gone, she said.
But there's another problem with your story.
What? Monica paused.
In movies, on TV, people tell reporters that things are off the record. Is that a real thing?
It's real. It means I can't print anything you say or attribute it to you.
But you could take what I say and keep,
like investigating.
If you find some other source to confirm what I say, you could write it up.
Laura shrugged. I suppose, but if you talk to me, it could mean finding out what happened to Patty. Isn't that worth the risk?
You might find nothing, and the Finch name could still get dragged through the mud.
She paused. It's not a nice story. I wouldn't ask if it wasn't important, but there's another little girl out there, very afraid, and so is her mother.
Monica tapped her fingers against the side of her leg, unsure, but she finally nodded.
They didn't just leave, they ran, she said. They ran away from my Uncle John. I know that much, because everyone knew it. Aunt Mildred shouted that part from the rooftops, told everyone she could in the week before she disappeared.
What did she tell them?
Monica grimaced.
That my Uncle John beat her. She went on and on about it, with very specific details. Things he did with a baseball bat, with a fireplace poker.
I thought you were just a little girl.
Oh, I was, but her stories were graphic enough to stick with people, and this is a small town. It came up more than once when I was growing up. Funny thing is, everyone had their own version of what Uncle John did to her. I used to think that was just because of time and retelling, like the telephone game.
But not anymore. Monica shook her head.
Now I think she was lying.
Laura said nothing, just waited for her to collect her thoughts.
I remember my cousin, at least, Monica said. I lived in town with my mom and dad, and Aunt Mildred and Uncle John lived out here with my grandparents. Memories when you're that young are few and far between, you know?
Laura nodded.
But I have this one vivid image. There's a barn behind the house here, and it used to be stocked with hay in the fall. Patty and I would climb into the loft and jump down again and again. It would kick up loads of dust, and the bits would float in the sunbeams coming in between the slats. Funny how you remember little details like that.
Laura said nothing.
And that's all I really remember. I was very young.
That's the whole story?
She shook her head.
No, I said that's all I remember. The rest of it is secondhand.
Promise me again you won't print this anywhere. Promise me you'll just use it to look for them.
I promise, Laura said, and meant it.
Monica studied her for a second, then nodded. She muttered under her breath.
If my mom was alive, she'd smack me for even thinking about talking to you.
It's bad, Laura said.
She nodded.
I never knew my father, so my mom and I were always close, but especially so toward the end. I had Francine, then got divorced and moved out here to be with her. So she helped me raise Francine from a baby, you understand? Got to see her grow up. Around when she started walking and talking is when it happened. I found her in her room one afternoon, and she was just sobbing. The kind of sobs that run through your body like a shiver and make it so you can't breathe. I never saw her like that before. I ran to her, held her, and in the course of that afternoon, she pretty much told me everything.
Laura tried to keep calm. She wanted to grab this woman and shake her, shake the truth right out of her. But it had to come in its own good time.
It started with my grandfather, I guess, she said, and stopped for a long beat. He molested her.
Your mother, Monica nodded, and my aunt, both starting when they were young, very young. That's what set it off. Seeing Francine in this house was like looking back in time, and the past was a very painful thing for my mother. She never got over it. All you need to see is a 60-year-old woman crying like a baby to understand that.
But my aunt, she said.
Your aunt?
My aunt was broken by it. She never recovered. My grandfather died when they were in their teens, and Aunt Mildred wouldn't believe it. They showed her the body, and she called it one of his tricks. No one could convince her he wasn't out there, just hiding somewhere, waiting to grab her.
That must have been crippling,
Laura said. More than crippling, it made her insane. Her father was an evil man, but she didn't put that label on him alone. It was his very nature that made him into what he was. Her gaze was unfocused, a faraway look in her eyes as she replayed her mother's story. It was like some kind of twisted syllogism, she said. My grandfather was a monster, and he was a man. Therefore, all men are monsters. And your Uncle John made her more sure of that. Monica shook her head. It got worse and worse as she got older. But even as a young woman, all those seeds had been planted. So when it came time to find a husband, she found just about the gentlest, most non-threatening man in the world. My Uncle John stood about 5'6" and had a stutter. He was a pushover. Hell, he was afraid of her. So all that talk about him beating her was a lie, Monica finished. He never laid a hand on her. Quite the opposite. He used to show up to church with a black eye. People used to make fun of him for it. Laura didn't laugh. And when she cried abuse and laughed, people didn't take it too seriously. She was crazy. Monica took a breath. It just so happened they never came back. That's terrible, Monica. Let me finish. Then you'll see Patty can't be the girl you're looking for. Isn't it possible they ended up in Hillsboro and that Patty became one of Hobbs's victims? I bet you're a good reporter, she said. Well, thanks. I bet you did a record search for Patty Finch. Laura nodded. And what did you find? She spread her hands. Nothing in North Carolina other than a school registration. I couldn't find any paperwork in Virginia, not even a birth certificate. From what I know, a serial killer has a very specific type of victim. Is that right? Laura frowned. And for Hobbs, it was girls. He liked little girls, right? Laura tried to cut in. I don't. And my aunt, she hated men. I don't understand, Laura said. She hated men, which is why she refused to even acknowledge she had a son. Aunt Mildred had to have a daughter. It was the only acceptable outcome. Laura stared at her. Monica paused a beat, waiting for her to say something, then filled the silence. There is no birth certificate for a girl named Patty Finch. Because she doesn't exist. Excuse me? Laura managed. Aunt Mildred's child. My cousin. His name was Patrick. Chapter 34. Alone in the car, she caught her breath. There was finally time to think. Patrick Finch. The name rolled around inside her head like a tire bouncing down a steep and endless hill. It blared in her ears like overwhelming static, glowed in neon etched on the inside of her skull. Patrick Finch. A boy living as a girl. She tried to imagine that. Before puberty, it was perfectly possible for a child of one gender to pass as the other. Hell, the girls were even a little bigger around 12 or 13. Patrick Finch had only been 10 when he disappeared. At that age, so many gender cues hinged on social convention. With long hair and a dress, who would know the difference? And on top of that, Patrick Finch had apparently been living as Patty for most of his life. She had no trouble believing he would be convincing in the role. After all, he had probably believed it himself. His own mother had conceived the ruse. Who would tell him different? Monica was so certain that there had been a mistake, that Hobbs would never have been interested in a little boy. Laura refused to speak the terrible thought. If Patrick had fooled everyone into thinking he was a girl, wouldn't he have fooled Hobbs too? She pictured that day at the racetrack in 1988. Hobbs lures what he thinks is a 10-year-old girl into his car. He takes her wherever he took the others, begins to do what he would do to them. This time is different, though. He quickly discovers that this long-haired, dress-wearing creature is male. And then? Laura shivered. That was the limit of her imagination. She didn't know what he would do. The surprise must have been almost as great for Hobbs as for Patrick. Would he kill the boy and dispose of the body? Keep him alive? Nothing good, that was for sure. Two or three of the different thoughts bouncing around in her head, locked together like magnets. A person seemed to have a vendetta against Eugene Hobbs, a man who killed young girls. Until now, she had only guesses about the man in black's identity. A father, an uncle, a brother. Someone seeking revenge. The stumbling block had always been this killer's pathology. A simple vendetta didn't explain the murder of Olive Hansen. Who would hate Hobbs but also emulate him? No one fit the bill. Until now. Now she had the perfect candidate. What if Hobbs hadn't killed that little boy? What if Patrick Finch was still alive? It was almost 5 by the time she made it back to Hillsborough. The sun would be down in less than half an hour, and the house was creeping into shadow. She parked the Dart and unlocked the front door. "That you?" Her mother's voice sounded shriller than usual, but it still came from the living room. She poked her head in. "Yes, it's me." Diane Chambers did her best to turn in her recliner. "People been knocking all day looking for you. Where you been, girl?" "Out. Who's been knocking?" Her mother snorted. "Nobody for me. Some deputy came by." Laura paused. "What did they want?" "I don't appreciate being your errand boy, just waiting around the house to sign for your packages. He brought a box." "Where is it?" "You could have at least given me a little warning so I could put my face on. He was a nice-looking young man, and you..." She grabbed her mother by the arm and squeezed. "Where is it?" "Laura, no need to." She squeezed harder. Something changed in her mother's eyes. The narrow slits of irritation went wide. Her lips started to tremble. When she spoke, her usual rasp had a quaver. "Laura, you're hurting me." She kept squeezing. "It's in the back room somewhere," her mother said. "He put it back there for me." Laura found the box and popped off the top. Plastic bag stuffed it. She pulled the first one out, stared, and almost dropped it. It was the shirt she'd been wearing in the mountains the day Frank was killed. Tiny holes salted the chest and left shoulder, peppered with wooden splinters in the aftermath of the shotgun blast. Dirty brown molasses stained the fabric. Blood. Her blood or Frank's. She didn't know. Probably it was both. Underneath the shirt, individually bagged, were her pants and underwear and socks. She didn't know why they hadn't burned at all when they were through. At the bottom, she found two more items. Her hiking boots were a little mud-caked, but looked otherwise in good condition. She pulled them out. The box was almost empty now. She reached in, felt around, came out with her father's Browning. It was in a plastic bag, with a little tag tied around the trigger guard. She got it unwrapped and tore off the string. Worked the action. The metal didn't slide smooth, but it was nothing a little oil wouldn't fix. She lay it on the ink blotter of her father's desk, sat in his old chair, and pulled open the bottom drawer. Behind old magazines and faded receipts, she touched rags and a bottle of gun oil. The Browning came apart just as she remembered, and it only took a few minutes to lubricate the moving parts and slide them back together again. She ejected the box magazine, and from a pocket of her own bag, she recovered the last 4 rounds from the box in the basement. One by one, she slid them home, then put the Browning in the back of the drawer and shoved it closed. "Who else knocked?" she asked her mother. "Some little shit playing ding-dong ditch, most likely." "How do you know it was for me?" Her mother started to laugh, but it turned into a chest-racking cough. It took her a second to catch her breath. "Of course it was for you. More people trying to get under your skin." So nobody was at the door. Not that I could see, but they were all around the house, rapping on the doors, scratching at the windows, never said a word. Goosebumps raised a pattern on her arm. When was this? "Hell," her mother rasped. "I heard it out back just before you pulled up." Laura kicked off her flats and pulled on the hiking boots, then stuck her hands through the arms of her sheepskin coat.
You going out?
Probably just some asshole, Ma, she said. Maybe I can catch him.
When her mother turned back to the television, she opened the desk drawer and slipped the Browning into her coat pocket. Out on the front porch, she looked down the center of the driveway but couldn't see anything. She made her way off the side of the porch and around the back of the house, careful at the corners, studying her surroundings. The western horizon bled a dwindling orange, and to the east, the sky was shrouded by a wall of dark cloud, the harbinger of a winter storm. Wind licked beneath the eaves, and the old farmhouse hummed. The rear wall of the house was featureless, so she kept her back to it and directed her attention outward, waiting for something to move. There was nothing to see but the small stand of river birch, devoid of life, and the tree line at the back of the field almost a mile distant. A sound came from behind her. At first she thought it was the fluttering of birds' wings. But no birds flew this time of the evening, and no birds roosted at the Chambers farmhouse. She turned and saw it. A picture. A small metal stake pinned it to the wooden siding, and it trembled in the wind. Laura took her finger off the butt of the gun and let herself take a breath before ripping it from its pin. The thin paper fluttered in her hand, and her own bloody image flickered into sight and then disappeared. Over and over, as though part of a demonic flipbook. It was the same picture that had been mailed to her, cut from the exact same edition of the News and Observer. She turned the picture over, and her hand went to her mouth. Thick black lines blotted out the newsprint on the back, filling up the paper. It was the same neat block lettering from the package sent to the Gazette. Dear Laura, I'm so happy we get the chance to talk again. Even like this. During our last conversation, you asked me if we could meet, and I told you the time wasn't right. I have a surprise for you. The time is now. Have you looked up at the sky? The full moon is rising, fat and red. A blood moon. This night is holy. This is the night for sacred transformations. Follow my instructions if you want to know what happened to Teresa. Follow my instructions, or Samantha dies. If you lie to me, I'll know. I'm watching you. Laura could feel the drone of her heartbeat on her temples and in the ends of her hair as they stood up. She flipped the picture over onto its front, then over again to read the message again. Instructions. There were no instructions. She had to call Fuller, or Tim. He'd made direct contact again, and this time the proof was in her hand. She fumbled for her phone, pulled it out of her pocket, and it vibrated in her hand. The text icon popped up on the screen next to an unfamiliar number. She touched it. I'm watching you, Laura. I'm watching you right now. Her knees felt like they might go out from under her. She scanned the horizon, couldn't see anything in the gathering dark. The phone buzzed again. Hold the phone above your head. She didn't move. Could he really see her? The sun had set. The far end of the field was very far away. But high-powered binoculars existed. Telescopes, too. Night vision was a thing, she reminded herself. And how else would he have known the exact moment to text her? She felt the phone pulse in her hand. I'm waiting. She extended her arm as high above her head as she could and looked up at it. Good. There is a rock 10 yards north. Place phone in pocket. Hold both hands above your head. Walk to the rock and pick it up. Her first instinct was to run around the corner, into the house. In a matter of seconds, a heavy wooden door could be between her and whatever lay hidden in the dark. She tried to turn, but couldn't move. Her legs had turned to stone. All she could picture was a scared little girl already missing an ear, if not her soul. She pushed the phone into her pocket, raised her arms above her head like a robber coming out of a bank, and walked north. The walking bought her time to think. She didn't fully understand his interest in her, but the logic of this small portion of his plan was becoming clear. These movements were designed to prevent her from sending a distress message of any kind. With her hands above her head and the phone in her pocket, he would know if she used it. And then Samantha Powell's blood would be on her hands too. If she called, the girl would die. And if she didn't call, well, she had a feeling Laura Chambers would just disappear. It was a lose-lose situation. And when it